I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a fresh look inside Hillary Clinton's failed presidential campaign. But first, Russia and Georgia agreed to end their six-day-old war. But today, there are reports that Russia is continuing to send troops and tanks into Georgia. And today, President Bush said he's skeptical that Russia is holding up its end of the truce.
We expect Russia to meet its commitment to cease all military activities in Georgia. And we expect all Russian forces that entered Georgia in recent days to withdraw from that country.
The fighting began when Georgia launched an offensive last week to regain control of the separatist region of South Ossetia. Russia responded by sending troops there and eventually into Georgia proper. John Wendell is a photojournalist for the Christian Science Monitor. And John, can you tell us where you are right now and what you've seen?
So I'm in Vladikavkaz. It's the capital of North Ossetia. Today, we went down to the border, almost got arrested again. They kind of tightly control the foreign media here. So we went down there. We were trying to find out if Russian troops were moving in or moving out of South Ossetia, the disputed region between Russia and Georgia right now, mostly because Medvedev, President Medvedev last night said that there was a ceasefire, and we wanted to kind of see with our own eyes whether troops were moving in or out. What we saw was maybe half a dozen to a dozen fuel trucks moving gasoline in for tanks and troop transport, that sort of thing, plus probably, I'd say, maybe two dozen troop transport trucks, which could be anywhere between 200 and 300 troops moving in. So I don't think that what Medvedev is saying is true, especially after hearing that there's been pitched battles in Gori today, the second largest city in Georgia.
Right, right. So you do, the news reports do suggest that Russian tanks are going into Gori, which is just south. It's in the center of Georgia, just south of where you are.
Correct.
So right now you're in North Ossetia, which is in Russia. You were in South Ossetia yesterday, which is,
yeah,
as you said, the disputed region and where this conflict started. What did you see in South Ossetia yesterday?
Well, we were the first group of Western journalists to be allowed into the country. So we went down there about 40 kilometers from the border. They put us into an armored personnel carrier because they're still afraid of Georgian snipers. And we were with people from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs who came down here from Moscow to manage the media situation. So it was a pretty tightly choreographed tour. We rode in on an armored personnel carrier, and we got into the suburbs, and one of these special forces soldiers saw that I had a camera, and he tapped me on the shoulder, and he told me I could poke my head up. So I poked my head out of the hatch, and what I saw was just a residential neighborhood, a standard Russian residential neighborhood. You have houses, you know, with big, tall steel fences around them, you know, nice courtyards, grape vineyards and everything, and these were burning.
They were burning.
You know, and yeah, I'd say about 20% of the houses were on fire. Another 20% had been gutted by previous fires. There wasn't a single window left in the whole suburb. And then we got further down towards the center. We went to the site of a big tank battle, and there were two blasted apart tanks down there. You know, the fire that resulted from that was so hot it melted the main machine gun. And a turret from a third T-72 had been blown off into the side of a building. I saw some pretty nasty stuff down there, and there's just kind of old people walking around, kind of dazed with their grocery bags, but there's no food to put in the bags. So lots of guys running around, you know, camo pants, but white sneakers and T-shirts, running around with Kalashnikovs. I saw probably a 15-year-old boy riding in the back of one of the cars here with a Kalashnikov between his legs and his school clothes. The situation is pretty fluid and pretty unregulated. Mm. So that's why it's so dangerous to operate even behind Russian lines, because They don't control everything. So
now Russia says that the reason that it went into South Ossetia to begin with was because Georgia was committing genocide in that area. And if Russia's running these tours, I'm assuming that they may also be trying to show you evidence to back up that claim. Is that happening?
No, they haven't tried to show us that. Like I said, it was pretty choreographed. So we went into a hospital that had supposedly been bombed, and you know, they brought out, they kind of trotted out wounded old people and soldiers and who proceeded to talk to the press and that sort of thing. But they haven't shown us any evidence of mass graves or, you know, villages that have been razed to the ground.
John Wendell is a photojournalist with the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with us from North Ossetia. John, take care.
Thank you.
Senator Hillary Clinton will have a primetime speaking slot at the upcoming Democratic convention in Denver, but we're getting a new glimpse into why Barack Obama is the presumed Democratic nominee for president. The Atlantic magazine is out with a story this week that essentially airs the Clinton campaign's dirty laundry. The story includes several memos and emails from the Clinton campaign about money problems, bitter arguments, staff undermining each other, and Clinton's failure to resolve some of these problems. Atlantic senior editor Joshua Green wrote the story, and he joins us now. And Joshua, what's the big picture overall that you got from these campaign emails and memos?
Well, the big picture was that of a campaign whose advisors were constantly at war with each other, and a candidate who did not seem to realize what was going on at first. And then when she did, never really stepped in and made an executive decision to say, I want to do this or I want to do that. And as a result, you saw the kind of rolling calamity that unfolded across the spring and I think ultimately cost Hillary Clinton the nomination.
What was the biggest disagreement, do you think, or maybe the biggest division that the public would know from watching this campaign?
Well, I think the biggest division the public would know was the one among her advisors who have a long history of factionalism and rivalry, backstabbing each other in the press. For a long time at the beginning of the campaign, that didn't really bubble up. But once Clinton began to get into trouble, you began to see these kinds of leaks, especially against her chief strategist, Mark Penn. And it really proved a big distraction for the campaign. What the memos and emails that we have on our website show is that battle was really won over strategy, and that there was really an argument going on between two groups of her advisors about whether to run a positive strategy that would build up Hillary Clinton or whether to run a negative one that would really attack Barack Obama and make him unelectable. And that was the decision that Clinton herself never stepped in to resolve.
These emails were provided to you from these staff members, and in the article you say the fact that they gave you these materials proves that paranoid dysfunction breeds the impulse to hoard. but why did people give all of this to you, do you think?
I'd like to think it's my my winning smile and personal charisma, but I think in reality, people are very, very angry and disillusioned with what happened. I mean, if you think back even 18 months ago, it was all but assumed that Hillary Clinton would not only be the Democratic nominee, but would probably be the next president of the United States. And the fact that she's not going to be has been very hard for a lot of these people to swallow. These are powerful people with big egos, and they're very, very angry that things went wrong.
And they're still simmering and still willing to air these battles out in the media.
Evidently, yes, yeah, yes.
Yeah. Some of the things you talk about, you mentioned Mark Penn, and he was a key figure in the campaign until that expose in the Wall Street Journal, which said that he was lobbying on behalf of a free trade agreement with Colombia, which was an agreement that Clinton was opposed to. Why don't you first tell us about his role and some of the leaks against him that were so problematic for the campaign?
Well, Penn, along with President Bill Clinton, was one of the two people who was very much on the side of running an aggressive, hard-hitting campaign against Obama, much, much more aggressive and hard-hitting than the one that actually unfolded. The memo that seems to have gotten the most attention is one that Penn wrote at the very beginning of the campaign on March 19th, 2007, wherein he lays out not only the types of people that Clinton wants to target, blue-collar workers, women, that sort of thing, but also has a section on what he calls Obama's, quote, lack of American roots, in which it suggested that the campaign really make an effort to try and paint Obama as something, other than American, foreign. They say he's, quote, fundamentally unelectable. Penn believed at that point that Obama was unelectable against any Republican other than Attila the Hun, he says in the memo. So you get a real clear, raw, vivid sense of what that side of the campaign was arguing in 2007.
And it also appears that Bill Clinton agreed with Penn on taking a hardline approach against Obama, and Hillary did not. And you cite the example of that ad and the decision to run that 3 a.m. ad against Obama.
The way that came about is that Mark Penn actually got the ad approved by Hillary Clinton. She was in favor of running it. But then her staff kind of revolted, and there were a few days of arguing back and forth about whether or not they should air the ad. This was on the eve of the Texas and Ohio primaries. And even though the candidate herself had said, yes, I'm okay with this, the campaign didn't do it for a few days. And it took a phone call from Bill Clinton, a conference call in which he mediated the various sides of the dispute and then weighed in himself and said, let's run the ad. It took Bill Clinton himself in order to get the ad on the air. And in the fact, it proved very effective. She won in Ohio. She won about half of Texas. And the campaign really seemed to take off there for about a month. But as you mentioned, Penn ran into trouble with his lobbying on behalf of Columbia. And in a sense, the campaign at that point pretty much ran out of steam.
But even though he ran into trouble, he stayed on with the Clinton camp in an advisory role.
Yeah, and what these memos and emails make clear is that it was far more than an advisory role. He lost his title of chief strategist, and yet if you look at the memos, you can see ones dated after Penn was ostensibly demoted that show him out there cracking the whip, championing his strategy, pushing always to be more aggressive. And clearly there were parts of the campaign, again, Bill Clinton, who wanted to follow the strategy and were arguing really almost until the last minute to keep pressing it.
Was that an example also of indecisiveness about what to do about that expose of Penn? You know, the fact that they didn't just say, you're off the campaign.
Another of the interesting points that comes out in these memos and emails is really how thought through and influential Penn was as an advisor. There are other memos from very senior Clinton advisors like Harold Ickes and Jeff Garin, but the ones that really jump out are from Mark Penn. Whether or not you agree with his approach, he clearly had a well-thought-out, comprehensive strategy. In the sense I got, and I think the sense probably that Hillary Clinton got, was that he was really the only person who had clear ideas of what the campaign should be doing and could lay them out and present them on paper. Now, that may have worked to his detriment when you consider the fact that The Atlantic is publishing all these memos on our website. But it also helps explain, I think, why Hillary Clinton kept him around and kept listening to him, because he was the guy who had clear ideas at a time when really nobody else seemed to have any.
However, it took a long time for Hillary Clinton to act on some of these ideas and to make a decision one way or the other.
The sense I have was that Clinton herself never decided between either of the two strategies, and what she tended to do instead was drift back and forth in terms of which group of advisors she let influence her. On some days, she'd be very aggressive and say, you know, shame on you, Barack Obama, and really go after him. Then the next day, she'd be up on stage with her mom and with Chelsea, and be presenting herself almost as like a Hallmark Channel mom. So Clinton herself never really decided one way or the other. And one of the things that becomes clear in these materials is that all factions of the staff became more and more upset and aggrieved, lobbied harder and harder for their own point of view, and eventually just descended into this chaos and backstabbing that seemed to send, you know, even some of the most sober and discreet Washington wise men off, you know, writing hysterical emails about how we need to stop the infighting and stop leaking in the press, but they were never able to do so.
Josh Green is senior editor at The Atlantic. We'll have more with him after a break. We'll be back in a minute. It's Here and Now. We're back with Josh Green, senior editor at The Atlantic. He's written a new article about Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Green got access to emails and memos from Clinton campaign staffers that paint a picture of quite a dysfunctional campaign. And Josh, before the break, you mentioned how the infighting among the staff in the Clinton campaign really overwhelmed even the most experienced Clinton advisors, including Robert Barnett, who finally got fed up about the leaks to the press. Why don't you tell us about that?
For those who don't know, Bob Barnett is sort of the stereotype of the thoughtful, discreet Washington power broker. He's been the Clintons' personal attorney for years, represents a lot of other important people, I think Democrats and Republicans. And he's a sort of guy that experienced politicians like to have around in their corner, because no matter how bad things get, he's always there to offer sage advice and counsel. And on March 6th, after the Washington Post did a front page story on the Clinton campaign full of leaks, this is 2 days after Clinton's heroic comeback in Ohio, when the spotlight should have been on the candidate. Instead, there was a long front page attack piece in the Washington Post that was directed at Mark Penn, and was really sort of page after page of backstabbing by other people in the campaign. And finally, Barnett, you know, this embodiment of discretion, sends an email to Hillary Clinton and CCs a lot of the top staffers and just says, stop it. This is a circular firing squad. This is unprofessional. This is unacceptable. So you can see that the tensions and the rivalries really finally did in just about everybody who was associated with the campaign.
You know, it's very ironic because obviously Hillary Clinton was campaigning on her strength as a manager and a leader.
Her line was that, you know, I'm the candidate who's ready to do the job from day one, implicitly suggesting or explicitly suggesting that she had the executive managerial skills to step right into the White House and take care of business. Anybody could have seen at the end of the campaign, and it certainly becomes clear in these memos and emails, the one thing that was really lacking was the candidate herself stepping in and making an executive decision, stopping her advisors from going after each other and kind of refocusing the campaign on a single strategy that might have won her the nomination.
You also say that there were times that Senator Clinton herself would erupt against staff members. Was this commonplace, A? And do you think that that attitude is what caused a lot of these problems? It was sort of a top-down kind of thing.
I think it caused some of these problems. I mean, she tended to be very busy out there campaigning, assume that the staff that worked for her was taking care of business, and then every once in a while when it became clear to her that they weren't or that things were going awry, she would hold a conference call with her staffers and absolutely explode. And they would respond by kind of panicking and in an effort to please her, do things that wound up backfiring for the campaign. Mm. And one of the colorful examples that I'm sure people will remember is the attack that the campaign made against Barack Obama for having written an essay as a kindergartner in which he said that he wanted to be president. After one of these Clinton blow-ups in December of 2007, the campaign released this kind of over-the-top attack on Obama that to anyone else seemed kind of ridiculous on the merits and quickly became picked up by, you know, late night comics, and the campaign was mocked for a week afterward. But what you see in these emails is actually how that attack transpired and how Clinton kind of cracking the whip and yelling at her advisors caused them to go ahead with what turned out to be a pretty short-sighted attack. The irony in all this and sort of the sad thing if you're a Hillary admirer is that what she did then was to sort of take the campaign on her own shoulders, ignore the advice of her staffers, kind of throw open the town hall meetings, take questions. She completely changed her campaign style, and it worked. She won, you know, she had this epic comeback in New Hampshire. Things were really cruising for a while. So at key moments, she proved to be her own best strategist, but for whatever reason, she never really managed to sustain that beyond one or two states at a time.
You know, there's a recent article in Rolling Stone that compares the Obama and Clinton campaigns, and it sort of paints the Obama campaign as a bottom-up effort, a grassroots building support effort, and says, you know, there were no egos involved. And the Clinton campaign, on the other hand, full of egos, full of bitterness, and I think that the article describes it as, quote, the last antiquated vestige of the top-down model. Is there a message from this campaign, do you think, that will tell future presidential candidates how best to run their campaigns, or was this just something that was happening because it was 2008 and these were the candidates?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I think the enthusiasm from the ground up in the Obama campaign, coupled with the fact that it had excellent management, really explains why Obama won. And I think the fact that Clinton had such chaos at the very top of her campaign also explains why she lost, because that chaos kind of then filtered down to the fundraisers and the grassroots, and there were never really clear instructions on what everyone should be doing.
Mm. You know, in the New York Times editorial page today, Maureen Dowd writes that leaking these memos to you essentially undermines Obama's campaign and the picture of unity among Democrats that will likely be presented at the upcoming convention. We do know that Hillary's going to speak at the convention in Denver. Do you think that this will harm unity, the unity image at the convention, and what should we expect from Hillary then?
I have my doubts about how many people have bought into the unity image anyway. Certainly it's been difficult for the two campaigns to bridge the divide, and I don't think that that's a tension that's going to go away before the Democratic convention. But it's funny, the person I thought this would really affect when the piece came out was John McCain, because it's McCain's campaign that so closely resembles Hillary Clinton, both in the chaos between his senior advisors and kind of the backstabbing and fighting in the press, and also the kind of strategy that McCain's running that very consciously, as Mark Penn wanted to do, paints Obama as someone foreign, as someone who can't be trusted, and kind of wraps McCain in the American flag, which is exactly what Penn wanted to do for Hillary Clinton.
And have you heard from any of the Clinton staffers who provided you with some of this material for your piece? What's their reaction, Penn?
The reaction on the whole has been, interesting read, and, you know, why didn't you include this bit or that bit? But for the most part, I mean, look, you know, even the public who watched this on TV and could see it unfold, I think had a pretty good idea of what happened before the article came out. What this does is kind of explain and reveal some of the particulars. But I don't think anybody, certainly not even Clinton's advisors, would argue with the big picture of the piece that this was a campaign that finally descended into chaos and that was what ultimately cost the candidate the nomination.
Josh Green, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much. It's good to be with you.
And we'll be back after the news, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're now going to catch up with what's been happening at the Olympic Games in Beijing. U.S. swimmer Michael Phelps keeps breaking records and has won the most Olympic gold medals ever. Phelps captured his fourth and fifth gold medals last night. He swims again on Friday. Shira Springer is covering the Olympic Games for the Boston Globe. And Shira, we spoke with you last week about the opening ceremonies and we could barely hear you through the cheering crowds. Has that excitement level kept up?
No, it's a bit strange. There seems to be sort of a lack of joy or a lack of energy right around the main venues. Now, I'm staying in the Olympic Green area, which is a very tightly controlled, very secure area. So instead of having these normal Chinese kind of wandering about, you have a very sort of sparse crowd meandering through the Olympic Green. Inside some of the venues, though, it's been quite exciting.
Mm-hmm. Track and field coming up, that will bring a lot of attention and a lot of cheering to the games. What else do we have to look forward to later this week and into the weekend?
First of all, you have some of the individual finals in men's and women's gymnastics. I think that's going to be terribly exciting. One of the other stories that I know I'll be watching is sort of the doping scandals, especially with track and field picking up. And there is some concern that there will be more positive drug tests coming down the pipe.
Well, let's hope not. And how's it been covering this, Shira? Has it been exciting? Has it been very different for you?
I love seeing the smaller countries take a lot of pride. I mean, India won its first gold medal the other day, I believe, in shooting, and they're ecstatic. And I also think it's fascinating to see how the international media works. Just to go back to Phelps, when he entered his press conference earlier today after winning his fourth and fifth gold medal, not the American press corps, but the rest of the international press corps cheered him. So it's just a fascinating thing to see how U.S. athletes are received and how things operate.
Boston Globe sports reporter Shira Springer, who is speaking with us from Beijing. Thanks for being with us, Shira.
Thanks for having me.
Well, 28 years ago, the Summer Olympics were held in Moscow, but the U.S. boycotted them because of Russia's invasion of Afghanistan. Sue Walsh was a young competitive swimmer back then, eyeing gold. More than two decades later, she's still racing, setting six world records at the 2007 U.S. National Masters Swimming Competition. Rachel McCarthy produced this profile of Sue Walsh.
I'm Sue Walsh, and I really have to tell you my age. I'm 46. And I guess it was about the age of 13, 14 when I realized I might have some potential. I made junior nationals and actually won as a 14-year-old in the 100-yard freestyle, and it was in 1976, which was an Olympic year. I'm getting goosebumps now thinking about it because you watch the swimmers do well and get up on the award stand and hear the national anthem being played. And I think that's where you get that picture of that's what I want to do someday. That's the position I want to be in.
My name is Shelby Stankavage. I'm 16 years old and Sue Walsh is my mom. Recently, I wrote a research paper on my mom. Walsh was a senior in high school at the time of the 1980 Olympic Games. She doubled up on her classes her fall semester in high school so she could graduate early in an effort to focus on training for the Olympics. When Walsh heard the news, she was devastated.
I remember that exact moment in January, sitting in front of the TV at my parents' house and watching the president make the announcement that the U.S. would be boycotting and just sitting there almost in disbelief.
That with Soviet invading forces in Afghanistan, neither the American people nor I will support sending an Olympic team to Moscow.
Of course I was disappointed. At 17, I didn't understand why that decision was made, how they really thought it was going to impact anything, and sat there and thought, wow, I miss my graduation, I miss my prom, and why? So that was tough, but swimming as a, in particular as a collegiate athlete, it was a big part of who I was, and people would be like, oh, there's Sue Walsh, the swimmer. You know, those two things, Sue Walsh and swimmer, always were put together.
Walsh would be a senior in college when the 1984 Olympics rolled around and soon realized just what an impact the 1980 Games had on her dreams.
Here I was a senior in college. This was pretty much going to be my last chance of making the team because at the time you pretty much would retire after you finished your college career. So I think just having that added pressure was difficult for me because I knew this was it. All of my training, everything had to be, you know, focused on this one meet. And I was the American record holder. I had won the NCAA titles, and so I was the one that everybody was looking at to beat.
At the 1984 Olympic trials, Walsh developed a sinus infection and placed third in her best event.
Apparently, I was winning through a good portion of the race. And then the last, I guess, maybe 15 meters or so, I started to really tire, and I saw the flags and dove for the wall as best as you can when you're doing backstroke, turned around, looked up at the scoreboard, and saw that I had gotten third in the 100 freestyle by a hundredth of a second.
Her dream was crushed.
And I just wanted to throw up at that point. And I just do remember the two people who beat me having to go and be tested for drugs. Just, you know, they were doing that for all of the people that had made the team. And actually, I was asked to be drug tested, and that was like almost insulting. You know, I have to actually sit around here and just bemoan the fact that I'm not on the team. And I think that was the hardest part about the 1980 boycott, was that now I had no chance. I mean, that was it. And unfortunately, you know, I had to go home where other people were then going on to Los Angeles to compete.
There's one more country to enter the stadium.
United States of America.
And here they come. Pride in yourself, pride in your country. There it is.
That was a thorn in my side, the one thing that I haven't accomplished. But after a number of years, I think the emotions, I guess, got less. It took a while. But then as I had children and watching them swim, I just really missed that point where you can kind of prove yourself. But I forgot the fact that training goes with competing. And so the first few weeks, if not year, was a struggle. And that was around the 2003-2004 period. And I guess I've been training for about 2 months. And my chest started hurting. And so I tried to get out of the water and walk it off. It didn't get any better. And I kind of joked to the coach. I said, well, if I don't come out of the locker room anytime soon, come and get me. They did some tests and said, we need to keep you because we think you've had a heart attack. And so I, you know, had to spend 2 weeks just kind of swimming 500 yards, very easy. It was very, very difficult for me to kind of pull back. And I really, at points, was questioning my decision to get back in it because it was really a lot of work. Went to my first competition and I was as nervous as I was as an 8-year-old. And I thought, okay, I'm 40-something. I'm not supposed to be getting nervous over a swimming race. But thus far, in just about every meet, I've been able to get, you know, at least a little bit faster.
And look at lane number 4, Susan Walsh from North Carolina. She'll touch first, 24.00 for Susan Walsh. That's a new national record.
You cannot get any closer to 23.9 than 24.00.
She texts me and goes, I wanted to break 24, but I went 24.00. Darn. Most people would be ecstatic for making an American record.
When I was in college, I went a 22.9, so a little over a second off. But I, you know, gosh, I figure after having 3 children, that's not bad.
Our story was produced by Rachel McCarthy. You're listening to Here and Now. What started as a class project on computer security wound up as a legal fight and an injunction against three undergrads at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The students found themselves in hot water when they tried to present their paper on computer security shortcomings in Boston's subway system at a hacker convention that was taking place in Las Vegas last week. The students say they weren't actually going to share enough details to allow anyone to cheat the system, but officials from Massachusetts say that isn't good enough. 21-year-old Zach Anderson is one of the students involved, and he joins us on the line from his native California. And Zach, can you tell us, what was this class assignment that's now in court?
Sure. It was a fairly open-ended project. It was based on a network or computer security project. You know, what we were trying to do is look at and analyze a, you know, subway system, the fare collection security. The system that is in Boston, the integrators actually make systems around the world. What we decided is we wanted to find out where the weaknesses were in the system, but also, on the other end, figure out ways in which some of those weaknesses could be mitigated.
And what did you find when you looked at the subway system in Boston and its electronic fare collection system? That's known, what, as the Charlie card, right?
I can't really go into details because of a temporary restraining order, but there definitely are issues.
Issues that, what, that will lead the system to lose money? I mean, can you generally say what issues you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I can't go into details about our research, but, you know, I would definitely say that I would be surprised if we were the first people to find some of these things. And someone else that finds these problems might not be so vocal to actually tell the operators.
The MBTA says that it first found out about your paper when somebody brought it to the authorities' attention that on the internet, there was a question saying, do you want free subway rides for life? And you were basically outlining the weaknesses of the system and advertising that there was a way to get around paying for the subway.
Yeah, the abstract did say that initially, you know, to call attention to the, you know, the serious issue that was present there. You know, can people actually get free subway rides for life? After talking to them, we decided that we should change that, because what we really were not doing during the talk is we were not going to give anyone any enabling information to actually get free subway rides for life.
And so this injunction is still in place, but it does expire in a couple of days, right? Then what?
That's right. It's a 10-day temporary restraining order. So we actually have a hearing on Thursday scheduled in Boston. We're going to see. I mean, really, at this point, we did not give the talk. It turned into quite a big controversial issue, which was really never our intention. You know, we wanted to, you know, make a contribution, not be controversial here. But they may file, you know, more motions to actually extend this restraining order beyond a temporary restraining order.
Mm-hmm. What grade did you get on the project?
We got an A on the project.
You got a lesson along the way.
We did, yes, indeed.
All right. Zach, thanks very much for speaking with us.
No problem.
Zach Anderson is one of three Massachusetts Institute of Technology students who wrote a report about the computer security shortcomings of the Boston subway system. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And now this note about a story we're following. A planned curfew in Hartford, Connecticut is angering civil libertarians. The American Civil Liberties Union of Connecticut may file a legal challenge against the city's temporary curfew for teenagers, which is to go into effect tomorrow. The city announced the 9 p.m. curfew Monday after a weekend shooting that resulted in the death of a 21-year-old man and injuries to six young people, including a 7-year-old and a 15-month-old baby. No one under the age of 18 will be allowed on the streets without a parent or guardian. We'll check in on Hartford's curfew later this week. Tomorrow on Here and Now, it's not just your credit cards anymore, it's national security. We'll look at the disruptions of Georgian internet sites and whether that opens a new front in warfare. We'll be back in a minute. It's Here and Now. Slow. Slide guitarist Elvin Bishop has been in the music business for more than 45 years, but he's still perhaps best known for his 1976 hit, Fooled Around and Fell in Love, sung here by Mickey Thomas. Elvin Bishop's longest love affair, though, has been with the blues, which he says he first fell in love with as a boy when he heard the song Honest I Do on the radio. Bishop explores his passion on his latest CD, The Blues Rolls On. Here's a little of the title track.
The blues is just a blessing from a long time ago, a thing people can feel deep down in their soul. It was here before we were born.
Elvin Bishop is touring the country this month, and he joins us to talk music. Welcome.
Hi.
As we said, you've had a longtime love affair with the blues. What first drew you to the blues?
I don't know. See, I'm pretty old. I'm 65. I was born in 1942, and for the first 12 or 13 years of my life, I think the best that I could do was Frank Sinatra or How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? You know, that's what we had to work with in those days. Then rock came in, and then one day I was fooling around with the radio, and I heard blues for the first time, and it just knocked me to my knees. I thought, wow, that is so... I finally found out where the good part of rock was coming from.
Right.
After that, it was like a dog on a bone. I had to go check out the blues.
That's your version of the song that knocked you out, Honest I Do. So how did you learn to play after that? Did you listen to everything you could get your hands on?
Yeah, well, I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma is where I lived, and it was pretty strictly separated racially, you know. Not pretty strictly, very strictly. And I couldn't really go and find people playing blues. I could hear it on the radio, and then I started gradually finding out where I could find the records. I learned a couple of chords, and slowly, and I'd pick up the guitar, and it hurt my fingers, and I didn't have any better sense. I'd go to the pawn shop, and I'd buy one that had strings 2 inches off the fingerboard, and it would just kill me to play it, you know, and I'd quit. And then I'd take another look, and I'd listen to blues, and I'd say, I got to learn how to do that. And I'd watch the girls hanging around the guitar player, and I'd say, I really got to do that. You know? I wasn't very good when I started out, but I went at it 24 hours a day, and I improved as fast as I could. I come all the way from Oklahoma.
Is there a part of you from Oklahoma that never really changed?
I grew up on a farm way out in the country, and we didn't have electricity or running water or any of that, you know. I always felt I had something in common with the old blues guys because I knew what it was like to live out in the country and 1,000 miles from nowhere. And boy, you know, I'm a lot better at playing it than I am describing it.
Hmm. Let's go back to growing up in Oklahoma. You left Oklahoma, right, to attend the University of Chicago. And that's where you met Paul Butterfield, and you eventually formed the Paul Butterfield Blues Band.
I met Butterfield the first day I was in Chicago. There was a guy, a white guy, sitting on some steps playing a guitar and drinking a quart of beer, and he was playing blues. And I naturally just ran right over there and gravitated, and it was Butterfield. And for 3 or 4 years, our paths intermingled and crossed, and we played acoustically at parties and stuff.
And on your new CD, you revisit one of the songs from the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, Yonder's Wall. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Well, now your husband went to war. I heard it was kind of tough. Don't know how many men it killed, but I know it's not killing them. But you look over yonder's wall.
KKK. Well, I know you don't love me, cause baby, look who called your man.
Your new CD, The Blues Rolls On, is a tribute to some of the musicians who helped give you your start. And I'm sure that, you know, when you're young and you're passionate and that's sort of your driving force, you probably needed a lot of those musicians to help you out. Is that right? Is that what this CD is?
Yeah. It was a great blessing to me. It was, guys were much nicer to me than they had to be because I wasn't anybody. Like they used to say in Chicago, I was square as a pool table and twice as green. And the guys were really nice enough to bend over backwards and help me out a lot.
And, for example, on this CD, you invite the king of the blues, B.B. King, to be a part of this. And
yes! What a guy. Oh, he's the most gracious human being in the world. And just a great hero of mine.
Yeah, he's in the song, Keep a Dollar in Your Pocket. Let's listen a little bit.
Hey, here's something you ought to know. You ain't nowhere unless you got some dough. Keep a dollar in your pocket. Keep a dollar in your pocket.
Personally, he influenced me a whole lot. The example he set for me when I was a relatively young musician when I met him, and I was maybe, having a little too much fun in spots, and and then I messed up and got a hit, and I was thinking maybe just a little too much of myself, you know. And B.B., when I first met him, he invited me up to his hotel in San Francisco, and I went up there, and here he was. He was, as far as I was concerned, the absolute pinnacle of the blues world, the number one guy. He lets me in his room, and he's got sheet music spread all over his bed. He's in his dressing gown, and he's just slaving away on these scales and exercises and stuff. I thought, wow, this guy's got it made, but he's just in the habit of progressing and bettering himself, and this was a great example for me.
Boy, that looks like B.B. King coming.
I've heard people say the blues is something that a musician lives, right? Something that an artist has to deeply feel. Now, how does a kid who's as square as a pool table and twice as green sort of get that depth of feeling that many people think is needed to be a successful blues artist?
It just seems like some people gravitate to blues. Blues is never going to be for everybody, like rap or country, you know, the hugely dominant musical form. For most people, I think music is kind of a surface thing, a trendy thing. You know, it's like hairstyles or clothing. But blues people, they want to connect the music up with life, you know. They want something deeper from their music.
Well, blues musician Elvin Bishop's new CD is The Blues Rolls On. It comes out next month, and you can also catch him on tour. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Elvin Bishop, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Now, hip-hop's hip and country's cool and rock is tough enough.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
I'm starting my stuff, y'all.